what we eat and why we eat something and what our preferences related to food, that's something that is heavily impacted by culture. So if our diet was determined only by biology, we would be probably eating a lot of insects, for example. There are, however, areas in the world where people do eat insects. And another example would be pork. We do eat pork, we eat a lot of it, and it is firmly embedded into our kind of traditional Czech cuisine. We have something that Czechs call zabijačka, which means that we literally process whole pig and all part of its body is consumed by the local community. But if you move to Muslim countries, that would be absolutely unacceptable. So culture is very important determinant for food and diet. There is a plethora of drinks or foods that are somehow affected. For example, alcohol, alcoholic beverages, again, acceptable in Europe. And compare this with again, Muslim countries where alcohol is forbidden.
I was reading about, for example, how far back three meals a day goes, and which is an interesting discussion in itself, because we often hear that breakfast is the most important meal of the day. But for centuries, I understand, breakfast was ignored, or in some cultures, even shunned.
Three meals a day is by no means a historical standard. I should probably say that the history of diet, history of food, is something that has been rather under-researched. What we know suggests that two meals a day would be the prevailing habit throughout medieval and early modern era, probably linked to the fact that a lot of people went to a mass in the morning and then they had like very early lunch and also some kind of evening meal. And of course, the question is, what would be the relationship between these two? What would be considered the main meal of the day and so on? The problem we face here is that we usually don't have very good resources that would describe diet of ordinary people. We have either descriptions of very rich, festive meals related to things like weddings of noble families, or, and this is perhaps better source, we also have, in case of certain religious orders, Catholic religious orders, we have detailed description of their prescribed diet throughout the day. But if you want to know about everyday diet for poor individuals, this, with very few exceptions, this is basically missing from our sources.
I want to get to the focus of the book you're working on at the moment, but I'll just add to that. Among the public, would you say that an interest has grown in historic foods over the years? Because I know, for example, when I visited towns like Český Krumlov 10 years ago, that there were suddenly restaurants opening up which offered in the menu traditional kinds of porridges, which would have added ingredients like flower petals and things like this. I was wondering if people are still fascinated, that they actually want to try some of these foods, and whether those recipes are accurate, I guess, is a question as well.
Definitely. I hope so. I hope that there is a growing interest in a historical diet. I definitely don't try to sell diet of the past as something that would be more healthy, because it is not. What I would like to focus on is to uncover those areas that may be a bit surprising for contemporary consumer. Things like, for example, the fact that in the past, there are two distinct kinds of cinnamon. So that's something you really don't encounter nowadays. There were, and there are two, at least two kinds of cinnamon. Or there were several kinds of pepper. Some of these are from real pepper, and some of these products are from completely different plants that nevertheless have the same kind of sensory quality, that sharp punch one thing that surprised me personally was that for example, chili has been part of chocolate recipes since the 16th century. So that's something you may perceive nowadays as a novelty, but it is not.
Let's talk about that. Your work is, or you are primarily interested in three beverages, which were consumed as far back as the 17th century?
Well, in Europe, 16th century. In Europe, it would be 16th century. But we shouldn't forget that before Europeans started to consume these caffeinated beverages, there were native people who were consuming cocoa or various recipes based on cocoa beans for thousands of years in America. And in China, the earliest archaeological findings are from the era before the Christian, from the times before the Christian era. So coffee is much younger. We presume that it is basically a medieval discovery, even in Arabic world. But in Europe, it's the 16th century when first people tasted these beverages.
In the case of chocolate, it came from the New World. It was one of the things that was brought back.
One thing I'm writing about is that I'm trying to kind of verify those very early descriptions of these beverages. So in case of cocoa beans, the first one comes from a history that was written by a son of Christoph Columbus, Hernando Colón. And this opportunity occurred in 1502. Although the description was published like 70 years later, and it was during the fourth Columbus voyage to the New World when he seized a native canoe, which was and there were several kinds of food, like maize, for example, and there were also cocoa beans. Europeans at that time had no idea what to do with them. They didn't know how to eat them. The only thing they obviously observed was that the natives put great value on these cocoa beans. And that's actually related to the fact that cocoa beans were used as a money in Mayan and Aztec society. So instead of having coins made of gold and silver, they were literally growing their money on a tree, and in case of very wealthy Aztec chieftains, they were literally eating their own money during festive opportunities.
How was it consumed at that time?
Well, that's an interesting point, because at the beginning it was consumed nearly exclusively as a drink that was valued particularly for kind of foamy top, and that foam was caused by high fatty content. Nowadays, we don't have fatty content in our cocoa because we are removing that fat as a cocoa butter. This is 19th century technology. But before 19th century, they didn't do it. And therefore the drink had different, I would say, sensory qualities than what we would expect nowadays. So it was a drink. However, the earliest Czech reference to cocoa or chocolate by coincidence refers to kind of sweets. So in both, it's dated pre 1650, 1645, 1650, around that time. So the Czechs are kind of outlier here, that our earliest reference is related to food, not to drink.
Mm-hmm. One more thing about the drink, about the beverage. Was it served hot? And there the chili comes back, doesn't it, as well as a slew of other ingredients?
Chili, cinnamon, cloves, something called achiote, which is basically coloring ingredient that turned the color of the drink toward reddish color, which also, you know, that's why natives believe that there is certain relationship between blood and chocolate drink. So there is kind of ritual meaning behind drinking chocolate. Actually, there isn't one kind of chocolate recipe. And natives definitely consumed several versions, including chocolate as a food mixed with maize flour. In Europe, it was probably consumed hot. We don't have many alternative recipes for cold version of the drink, but we know that that Aztecs did have cold version of the drink.
Is it fair to say that coffee and tea, as they were introduced, that they got a stronger foothold here and that the chocolate gradually faded?
That's yes, to a certain extent. This is related to which major political powers actually were linked to original introduction of these drinks. In case of chocolate, it is Spain. And we had certain relationship, a kind of exclusive relationship through the Habsburg family with Spanish Empire in the late 16th century. Rudolf II, the famous Habsburg emperor, was educated at a Spanish court. So that's chocolate. Coffee and tea are introduced, well, tea is introduced through the overseas route. So these traders were buying tea in China and transporting tea around Africa and were selling it on markets in Amsterdam and London. Coffee had two possible routes of introduction. The first one was similar to tea. The second one led through Cairo in Egypt and through Mediterranean area, thanks to, for example, Venice and other local trade centers, or through the Balkan area. It seems that chocolate was preferred by certain levels of society. There is, for example, there are documents, there are sources that show that it was particularly favored by members of religious orders for some reason. But most of Europe either started to favor tea or coffee. And while tea won in England, coffee became dominant in broader Central Europe, including Germany, Northern Germany, and so on. And there are usually economic reasons for which of these drinks was preferred, because of taxes and availability. The situation in England was different because they had the East India Company and the only comparable competition was Dutch East India Company. The Germans didn't have anything enterprise on comparable level. There are reasons, partially political and partially economical, for this preference.
So it comes down to the different markets, the business involved, mm-hmm. and market share.
Definitely, yes. Of course, linked to this, related to this, is then introduction of that particular culture that is associated with these drinks, and I'm talking about things like coffee houses, for example, or which were introduced for the first time in 1680s in Vienna. Actually, in Europe, probably English were the first one who witnessed the major coffee house boom. The whole second half of the 17th century, London had hundreds of coffee houses long before Vienna had. But in Central Europe, it would be Vienna. There are some very rare sources suggesting that there might be something like coffee house in Prague in the same period, but the earliest confirmed coffee house in Prague is like 1714.
I heard a joke about the English bemoaning the fact that before tea took over, that they would have been drinking beer at 4 p.m. instead.
This is one important point of what I'm doing here is before introduction of these non-alcoholic beverages, Europeans were drinking mostly alcoholic drinks. And the reason, there was some kind of, again, traditional cultural reasons, because wine, for example, was considered to be extremely healthy. But there were also practical reasons, because alcohol served as a way how to sanitize that drink, to avoid food poisoning. At that time, people didn't have microbiology, so they were unable to judge quality of their water sources based on content of bacteria, because they didn't have concept of bacteria. And therefore, drinking just water was always kind of a risky business. So even little children from very early age were drinking mildly alcoholic beverages. It was also linked to technological development, because there is a distillation technology that spreads across Europe and so on.
That is fascinating, though, that water was a questionable thing, because we take it so for granted.
Definitely. And in coffee, tea and chocolate, you have to boil the water. Therefore, you make it healthy. And then you can consume the stuff.
These drinks that we've been talking about, these beverages, they contain caffeine. Mm-hmm. And one of the final questions I have for you is, to what degree that was recognized or understood?
Physicians at that time had no idea. They perceived most foods and drinks as basically as a homogeneous mass. So, for example, wine wasn't thought to be mixture of water, alcohol. It was a homogeneous mass, homogeneous liquid called wine. So there was no concept of caffeine.
They didn't have the benefits of modern chemistry in any case.
Yes. But on the other hand, there are clear signs that physicians and other observers were aware of effects of caffeinated drinks. So, for example, there is a Jesuit, French Jesuit, Alexandre de Rhodes, in mid 17th century, who very quickly realized, and he was a missionary in Eastern Asia, and he realized that tea has ability to suppress sleep. And he was experimenting with tea, because his idea was, if I can suppress sleep completely, I might be able actually to do twice as much as I do, because I'm not going to be sleeping. So reportedly, he was able, in one case, he was able to stay awake whole week, skipping like six, perhaps seven nights. And then he realized that it is impossible, drinking tea in order to keep himself awake. And then he realized that that's impossible, and he settled on a regime where, when he basically skipped one night a week drinking tea, and thus extending his missionary activities.
You mentioned in other interviews the importance of languages, obviously, in this kind of research. You have to have a good understanding of Latin, and that's not all, Italian. That's one thing that kind of, I guess, guides your research as well. I wanted to ask you about the process itself, because this sounds truly like a huge detective story, that you start with one thread, and I imagine it's taking you around different archives all over.
Actually, you're partially right, but you're also wrong. It is a great detective story. I like history of medicine, because when students ask me what I do, I say that my research resembles a little bit main character from Da Vinci Code, if you know the series of books written by Dan Brown. There's a Professor Langdon who is a religious iconologist. And what I do is that I read old books from the 16th and 17th century. We have, for example, a magical book here in the treasury room of our institute. We have about 2,500 old printed books here in this building. And it's amazing to hold in your hands something that is about real magic, written by people who believe that if you do this, you will achieve certain kind of magical result. One difference between me and Langdon is that there is a complete lack of murders in my vicinity, which is kind of disconcerting, but perhaps it's going to change sometime in the future.
I hope not.
But one area where you weren't right was that I don't have to go to archives that much nowadays, because a lot of these books I draw upon primarily have been digitized in last 15 years, roughly. And now you have literally amazing library at your fingertips. And the only thing you need is those languages. So once you can read 16th century English, Italian, and Latin, you have a plethora of sources that you can use in your research.